Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 284 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. This is going to be a Step 2 CK podcast. It's going to be rapid review series number 48. In this podcast, I'm going to be going over some high-yield vignettes, some high-yield concepts that are often tested on the USMLE exams. And one other thing I would like to say is, again, if you're interested in signing up for the courses coming up, there's an MBME Step 2 CK test-taking strategies course. It's also very useful for people that are taking step three. It takes place on the 3rd of February. It's from 2 to 4:30 p.m. Mountain Standard Time. That's pretty much like 4 to 6:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Again, there'll be about 20 questions, and we'll go over like a very high yield approach to, you know, taking these MBME questions, especially like the step two CK questions, the step three questions, especially the stuff with the newer exam. And then from the 4th through the 6th of February, we'll do the 16 and a half hour course. I remember that was a 10 hour course before, but I expanded it by 6.5 hours so that I can go over content that's been tested since November of 2020. And also I'm expanding the medicine content, the OB-GYN content, the PEDS content. I'm expanding the content basically across all the disciplines so that I can better approximate, or, you know, better match up with the newer concepts that have been tested in more recent times. So let's just jump right into it. So what if they give you a question about a 23-year-old male, you know, he's involved in like a motor vehicle accident, and they tell you in the question that he has had like multiple fractures, and there's like this prominent fracture around his left hip. And then let's say there's some orthopedic surgeon in the question, he recommends that you do an ORIF, right? So an open reduction internal fixation. And then your friends at the MBME ask you, what is the most likely mechanism of healing that'll be applicable with this person getting like this fracture fixed by surgery, right? If you see something like this, I know some of you may be like, Divine, what? But I promise you, this stuff is very high yield to know for exams. It's very high yield to know for exams, right? So the thing you want to be aware of is intramembranous ossification, right? So whenever you do surgery, especially when you do like an open reduction internal fixation, that injury will usually heal by the process of intramembranous ossification. I guess the other method of ossification in this case is endochondral, right? Remember, endochondral ossification, the big thing there is you lay down bone on a cartilage precursor, right? It usually happens in long bones. And again, the intramembranous ossification I mentioned earlier, you don't have like the cartilage precursor to you laying down bone. You just pretty much lay down the bone directly on mesenchyme, right? So that's the kind of ossification that normally happens like in the face, in the mandibles, in the hips. Again, remember, long bones, that's more endochondral, right? But face, your mandible, hips, that's a lot of intramembranous. But again, if you're fixing a fracture by surgery, it's usually going to heal by intramembranous ossification, right? And the thing is, if you allow a fracture, though, to heal on its own, right? So like you let a fracture self-heal, then it's going to heal via the process of endochondral ossification, right? If you let a fracture self-heal, it's going to heal by the process of endochondral ossification. Sometimes, I guess, still talking around this whole bone business, right? Sometimes your friends at the MBME, they like to ask about like the stages of like healing of a fracture, right? And sometimes they even make you see if you can know the timelines, right? So remember, there's the reaction phase, right? So basically, you know, when you fracture, there's going to be all this acute inflammation, you're going to form all this granulation tissue. That's pretty much for the first week. And then from the second week all the way through, like, you know, 3 to 4 weeks, you have this repair phase, right? Essentially, that's where you try to like lay down cartilage, right? And then you form new bone on top of it. Again, endochondral ossification, if you're letting the fracture self-heal, right? And then there's the remodeling phase that usually occurs after like 4 weeks all the way up to like 3 to 5 years, right? And basically you make the bone that you've remodeled stronger. I think that's kind of like a big thing. And again, kind of going with this mantra of risk factors, prognostic factors, and all those things, right? A classic MBME question, again, is they can say, oh, how do you increase the likelihood of a person having like proper bone reformation after a fracture? If you see something like that, then I want you to think about adequate nutrient intake, right? In general, the more nutritionally, like if a person gets better nutritional rehabilitation, they'll very likely do better from that perspective, right? Okay, let's keep going. So what if they give you a question about like some 71-year-old female? They tell you that, oh, she just recently underwent like a right hip arthroplasty, right? 3 months ago, right? You know, so she had her right hip arthroplasty 3 months ago because she has been having, like, you know, chronic pain in her right hip. And then they tell you that, you know, she was doing well post-op. But then, you know, over the last 4 weeks, she has been having, like, decreased range of motion around that right hip. And then they tell you that, oh, on physical exam, you palpate like a warm, tender, firm swelling right around the joint. If you see this, what should you be thinking about? Well, I would really hope you're thinking about a heterotopic ossification, right? That's something that classically on exams is known as myositis ossificans. Okay, myositis ossificans. I remember it's pretty much a kind of metaplasia, right? It's a kind of metaplasia because you usually will happen like where you've had like joint, like a joint repair, or you've had like muscle injury or whatever, right? And then you undergo metaplasia. Instead of laying down like muscle or whatever, you're laying down bone, right? And then the person gets in trouble, right? So it can happen in trauma, right? And I will encourage you to be able to actually identify this on imaging. That's something they love to classically test, to be honest with you, on exams. So you see a person that just had trauma or whatever, and then it's like months later. It's not something that's going to happen within a few days, right? So pay attention to timelines and questions, right? So it's going to happen like months later, and then you notice that, man, I'm seeing like this thick radiodense substance. If you see that, that's pretty classic for myositis ossificans. Again, remember, another name they can give to myositis ossificans on an exam is heterotopic ossification. And then what if they give you a question about like let's say you have this 5-year-old guy brought to the pediatrician by his parents. And then they tell you that, you know, they've noticed that he snores a lot at night. And they tell you that he's in the question that, oh, the child's growth velocity, right, is in the third percentile. And they tell you that, oh, this child has a history of recurrent otitis media. And then they tell you that, oh, on physical exam, he has an enlarged head, he has a prominent forehead. If you see that, what should you be thinking about? I'd really hope you're thinking about achondroplasia, right? Achondroplasia. Remember, achondroplasia is one of these disorders, you know, it has autosomal dominant inheritance, right? Many of these structural bone disorders, right? Achondroplasia, osteogenesis imperfecta, right? Those tend to have like, those tend to have an autosomal dominant inheritance, right? And what's the pathophysiology behind achondroplasia? Remember, it's a gain of function mutation, right? It's an FGFR3 mutation, right? So fibroblast growth factor receptor 3 mutation, right? So it's a gain of function mutation, and that's how those people get in trouble, right? And you may ask, they may ask you on the exam, like, why is this child snoring? You want to know that, you know, it's because the child has obstructive sleep apnea, right? Essentially, the child has OSA. So that OSA is what's putting the child in trouble. Because again, when you have all these bone defects, sometimes it can mess up the anatomy of your airway and the child can have obstructive sleep apnea, right? And then another thing they can ask you is, okay, like, or you may be wondering, why, Divine, why does this child have a lot of otitis media, right? Again, it's because of dysfunction of the eustachian tube. Remember, that's almost like the primary mechanism behind most causes of otitis media, right? Just eustachian tube dysfunction. And I know some of you listening to this podcast may be like, Divine, you're talking about a lot of weird stuff today, like really weird stuff. Again, I will call to your attention that the exam has changed in recent times. I just want to throw that out there, right? So again, the USMLE Step 2 CK exam is becoming almost more Step 1-like in a sense. But it's not exactly Step 1-like, right? Like, it's almost like, it's not like they're inventing new diseases. They're just finding more unique ways of testing these things. That's why if you notice, my podcasts have a somewhat different bent over the last few weeks, right? So just something to keep in mind as you're preparing for these exams, right? And then what if they give you a question and they say, oh, for this child with achondroplasia, what is the percent of the child's offspring that will get the disease if, let's say, both parents are affected, right? If both parents are affected, it will actually be 50%, right? Because if you notice, you may be like, but Divine, if both parents are affected, let's say they are big A, little A, well, won't all their kids have the dominant whatever? Yes, all their kids will have the dominant allele. The only problem, though, is two of those kids will be, one of those kids. So let's do it, right? So big A, little A times big A, little A. You get one big A. That's, if you have both dominant alleles, child is going to die in a utero. That's the thing that's called the recessive lethal scenario. And then you have one big A, little A, another big A, little A, right? So those kids will have achondroplasia, right? And then you have one little A, right? Those kids will not have anything. Because remember, achondroplasia is autosomal dominant, right? So they'll have 50% of their kids will have achondroplasia, 25% of their kids will have no disease at all. They won't even have the allele. And then 25% will die in utero, right? Because again, if you have most autosomal dominant diseases, when you have both of the alleles, child is not going to make it to, not going to make it to term, unfortunately. All right? And then what would the percent offspring getting disease be if only one parent is affected, right? So if it's only one parent that is affected, it's still going to be 50%, right? Again, let's do the math here, right? So big A little a times little a, right? So you get a big A little a, another big A little a, right? And then you get a little a, right? So for the most part, right, like again, 50% of their kids will be affected, but 50% will not have any disorder, any achondroplasia, right? So if both parents are affected, one kid, let's say they have four, right? One kid will die in utero, so 25% won't even show up. 50% will have achondroplasia, and then 25% will not have any of the bad allele. They'll have like no achondroplasia. And then if one parent is affected and one parent is normal, so one is big A little a, the other one is little a, then two of their kids will have achondroplasia, so 50%, and then two will not have achondroplasia at all, right? So again, it's just kind of high yield to know these things. Again, I know it's a little annoying to keep these in mind, but please, I will encourage you, just know the stuff for your exam. And then, again, as I've said, right, again, a child with both bad alleles, like big A is not going to make it to term, right? Those kids just, you know, unfortunately, will not make it. Because if you really think about the pathophys, I know some of you may be wondering why in this case. I mean, the thing is, the child will not have proper formation of the rib cage, right? So if the child doesn't form the rib cage properly, then the lungs are not going to develop properly. So the child is essentially going to die of like respiratory failure, right? Basically, the child is not going to do well, right? Child is not going to do well. And then sometimes on exams with achondroplasia, I'm trying to be as thorough as possible with this disease. It's kind of high yield for the exam. Some OB-GYN considerations I guess you want to keep in mind is the fact that these kids need a C-section, right? So an achondroplastic woman, when she's delivering a child and you're worried about achondroplasia, basically, if you have achondroplasia when you're delivering kids, you should have them by C-section, right? Because the risk of cephalopelvic disproportion is too high, right? So you don't want the baby's head kind of being stuck and then you having like all these birth complications. I know some of you may be like, wow, I never knew you could test all this stuff with achondroplasia, right? And then what other thing is high yield to know about achondroplasia? It's actually high yield to know that these people have normal intelligence. They'll try to trick you into thinking that, oh, they're kind of like delayed in one way or the other. They're really not, right? And for the most part, who do people get this stuff from? It's usually from dad, right? And actually the risk, one of the biggest risk factors for achondroplasia is increasing paternal age, right? Increasing paternal age. So it's just one of those high yield things to know. And actually achondroplasia, if you see like just a kid that's a dwarf, is likely going to be achondroplasia. Achondroplasia is the most common genetic cause of dwarfism in the US, at least. And, you know, obviously you're taking the USMLE exam. Okay. Now, what if they give you a question about, you may notice I'm saying a lot about like bone things in today's podcast. That's kind of my focus. Although I'll maybe talk about some vascular things if I have the time. But what if they give you a question about like, you know, some child and they tell you that, oh, they have this incidentally discovered like, you know, like pedunculated or stalk-like radiodense opacity, right, on imaging. And they tell you that, oh, it has like a mushroom-like covering is attached to bone, right? And then it can even tell you that, oh, on physical exam, they palpate like a hard, mobile, painless mass, right, like around the right knee. And then they tell you that, oh, sometimes the patient has like this pressure-like sensation in this extremity with exercise. If you see this, what should you be thinking about? I really hope you're thinking about like an osteochondroma, right? An osteochondroma. An osteochondroma, again, don't forget like the stalk-like thing with it, right? So it looks pedunculated. I almost think of it as like a tubular adenoma of bone, basically. That's like a nice way to think about it. But essentially, right, those people, you know, they'll have their stalk-like density, has like a mushroom-like covering. It's actually the most common benign primary bone tumor, right? And for the most part, you just excise it, you just cut it off. And for the most part, the person will be fine. One thing to keep in mind is sometimes it's associated with like some genetic mutations, right? Like EXT1, EXT2. Especially when you see a child with multiple osteochondromas on exams, you want to think about those EXT mutations, right? You want to think about those EXT mutations. It's like a chromosome 8, chromosome 11 problem going on there. Okay, now what if they give you a question about like a 37-year-old Chinese immigrant, right? You know, presents, comes in, has like 3-month history of like right knee pain. And then they tell you that, oh, they obtain a plain film of that extremity and they see like a well-circumscribed lesion. And they tell you that, oh, it has a soap bubble appearance, appearance. If you see that, I would really hope on exams that you're thinking about an osteoclastoma, okay? Thinking about an osteoclastoma. Basically, it's almost like some things you may see referred to as like a giant cell tumor of the bone. And many times on MBM exams, what your friends at the MBM may ask you is, oh, if you were to take a biopsy of this thing, what would you likely find, right? You'll likely find like multinucleated giant cells. Okay, you'll likely find multinucleated giant cells. Okay, now what if they give you a question about like a 15-year-old male, right? And they tell you that, oh, he has a 3-month history of like severe pain below his left knee that is really bad at night. And they tell you that, oh, he has lost 15 pounds in that time period, right? What's going to be your diagnosis here? You see a young person, again, don't overthink this thing, right? Unfortunately, overthinking is a big problem with many med students, right? Don't overthink this thing. Essentially, this person has an osteosarcoma, right? Osteosarcoma, it's just kind of high yield to know, right? You see a young kid, has bone problems, especially like in the lower extremities, right? Having fevers, losing weight, probably going to be osteosarcoma, right? So what are some high yield things your friends at the MBA may expect you to know with osteosarcoma? Well, one important thing to know is the genetic associations, right? So remember that osteosarcoma is associated with people having like RB gene mutations, right? Like retinoblastoma. Remember, right? It can give you a question in that regard for a kid that has a white reflex, like a newborn having a white reflex instead of a red reflex, right? That makes you worried about retinoblastoma, right? That's an RB gene mutation. And then classically, they will ask, oh, these kids are at increased risk for which of the following malignancies in the future, right? And that your right answer, the answer you'll be picking on your test is an osteosarcoma, right? So the RB gene mutation is definitely associated with osteosarcoma. And also don't forget like the P53 gene mutation. Remember, P53 is the gene that is most commonly mutated in people that have malignancy, just in general. I mean, if you even think about colon cancer, right, you probably remember that AK53 pathway, right, where you have like an APC gene mutation and then that progresses to like a KRAS gene mutation, and then after that you get a P53 mutation, and then the person gets like full-blown colorectal cancer, right? So kind of high yield to know those, right? So, and whenever you have a P53 gene mutation, that's what's known as Li-Framani syndrome. So L-I and then a hyphen and then Framani, F-R-A-U-M-E-N-I, right? So Li-Framani syndrome. And then remember, there's other things that have associations with osteosarcoma, obviously, right? Like Paget's disease of the bone, right? Remember, when people have Paget's disease of the bone, you make the diagnosis with a bone scan, right? You make it with a bone scan because you see all the reactive changes that are happening in bone. It's pretty striking when you see it in real life. Don't forget that when people have Paget's disease, right, like pretty much all their calcium levels will be normal, with the exception of alkaline phosphatase, right? And, you know, I should probably speak to that alkaline phosphatase because, unfortunately, that's a lab that many med students seem to botch on exams, right? And, you know, it's not really fair for you to keep making that mistake, right? So elevated alk phos doesn't always mean that it's an obstructive liver problem. That's probably like the most common cause of elevated alk phos on MBM exams, right? Obstructive liver pathology, but that's not always the case, right? So remember that if a person has bone problems, that can elevate their alk phos as well, right? So classically, when a person has Paget's disease of the bone, their calcium, phosphate, everything will be fine. The only exception to that rule will be an elevation in the alk phos, right? So how do you tell an alk phos elevation that's you know, a result of bone problems from an alk phos elevation that is a result of obstructive biliary problems? The thing I would encourage you to think about in those circumstances is GGT, right? So if your alk phos is elevated but your GGT is normal, that's a bone problem. That's not an obstructive liver problem. But if your alk phos is elevated and your GGT is elevated at the same time, that is definitely an obstructive liver problem. Although remember, GGT can also be elevated because a person is a chronic alcoholic or the person just drank a ton of alcohol recently. And then another thing that can also help, this is like super sensitive but super helpful, is this thing called 5' nucleotides, right? So 5' nucleotides is also elevated in a person that has obstructive liver disease, right? So again, just keep this in mind. Elevated alk phos with normal GGT means it's a bone problem. Elevated alk phos with elevated GGT or elevated 5' nucleotides, that tells you that it's an obstructive liver pathology. And then what are some other things as well as osteosarcoma, which we were talking about originally? Don't forget teriparatide, right? Remember, teriparatide is a PTH analog that's used to treat osteoporosis, right? Remember, PTH kind of has this thing where if you give it in a pulsatile fashion, it actually makes your bone, you know, makes you build bone. But if you give it in a continuous fashion, you're going to resorb bone. So the thing with teriparatide is you give it in a pulsatile fashion, you use it to treat osteoporosis. But you can already begin to imagine a potential problem with that, right? You're literally giving a person a growth factor, or dare I say, like a stimulating factor for bone in those circumstances, right? So that can cause osteosarcoma. That's why you don't give teriparatide for more than 2 years, right? So the person doesn't get in trouble, right? And then you may wonder, like, Divine, like, when people have osteosarcoma, why does it usually occur in areas of bone growth? Because if you think about it, it doesn't occur in certain bones that just really don't grow much, right? It likes to occur like under the knee, you know, around the epiphyseal plates. Well, think about it. You know that many malignancies, right, love to have like, you know, very high mitotic activity. So it would make sense that a malignancy should be growing in a place that has like high bone growth just at baseline, right? It won't make sense for a person to get osteosarcoma in a place where bone doesn't really grow much, right? So like in general, people that have osteosarcoma, right, like it usually happens in a place where you have like rapid bone growth, right? Because whenever you have like a ton of rapid growth, there's a very high risk of people having mutations, right? And then those patients can unfortunately get in trouble, right? And again, don't forget your imaging findings for osteosarcoma, right? So these people have like, they can have like the sunburst pattern, they can have like Codman's triangle, they can have like a moth eating appearance to the bone, right? Those are all things that go with osteosarcoma. And then again, what is one of these classic ways that your friends at the MDME have kind of started making inroads into step one? Because again, step one is becoming pass failing, you know, like a year from now. One way they're making step two CK more like step one is sometimes they just describe histological findings on step two. They usually won't give you like a histological image. They just give you a histological description, right? So what is the histological description of osteosarcoma on MBM exams? The thing I want you to think about is they'll tell you that you see like mitotic cells in an osteoid stroma. If you see that buzzword, then I want you to think about osteosarcoma, okay? So you see mitotic cells in an osteoid stroma. If they mention that on a test from a bone biopsy, that's an osteosarcoma, end of story, right? And then what if they give you a question about a 12-year-old male and they tell you that he has like a 4-week history of like extreme right hip pain with high fevers, and they tell you that his ESR is super elevated, it's like 10-fold upper limit of normal, something crazy like that, and then his white blood cell count is 16,000. Right? So you see a person, you're like, this looks like a bone malignancy question, but it almost looks like osteomyelitis. Almost looks like the person is having like fevers, high white count. Whenever you see like, almost think of it as like infectious bone cancer. Whenever that's like a nice way to kind of wrap your head around the stuff. If you see this, I want you to think about Ewing's sarcoma, right? I want you to think about Ewing's sarcoma, right? And what's the pathophase with Ewing's sarcoma? Don't forget, right? You have like this 1122 translocation, right? So you make this EWS FLI fusion protein, right? And again, classically on histology, they'll tell you that, oh, you see like these small round blue cells, right? And again, don't forget that on imaging, you're going to see like this onion skinning pattern. And they may also use that moth eating descriptor that I use for osteosarcoma. But again, they'll give you many other factors in the question. It won't just be that moth eating part that will be like, oh, that's the end all be all for you to answer this question correctly. They'll give you more information in the Q-stem that will guide you in one direction versus the other, right? And again, remember, Ewing sarcoma has a very poor prognosis. You actually treat it with actinomycin D, right? Or dactinomycin, right? Remember though, that drug that's used to treat many of these childhood malignancies, right? So like Wilms tumor, Ewing sarcoma, stuff like that. Okay, and then I guess remember that there are, you know, on MBMEs, you want to know the malignancies that show up as like a blast that can cause like blastic lesions in bone or can cause lytic lesions in bone. So remember, breast and prostate cancer, they love to cause blastic lesions. In terms of lytic lesions, someone, I'd give a shout out to someone. This was on YouTube, actually, one of my YouTube videos. And by the way, again, if you're studying for step two, just quick segue here, I will encourage you to lay your foundation by just literally watching my shelf review videos first, right? Like, to be honest with you, like, the material, the content I have for people studying for step 2, CK, step 3, the best way to go about it is lay the foundation first by watching the videos on YouTube, listening to my neuro podcast series. And then after that, you then begin to jump into the podcasts that go for the different, like rapid reviews or those special topics, risk factors, and all those things. That's like the way, like, you go about like a thorough review for your dedicated period. And again, the materials I have for step 2 CK, they're pretty useful. At least I get emails from people all the time. I've had people get scores of almost like a 280 just from, you know, using my content, doing like the MBME practice shelf exams. I've had some people attend my course and get almost 280s and stuff. So just all things to keep in mind. Those materials are pretty comprehensive. They're pretty thorough, right? It's a lot of time. It's a big time commitment. But if you put in the time commitment, you'll be well worth your scores in the end, for sure. And again, I've had many people attend my courses that have, been really successful with it, right? And then, so going back to the mnemonic, right? So the lytic bone lesions, right? So lytic, right? Like, this person gave a mnemonic. Like, lytic is like LTK almost, right? So the L is for lung cancer, T is for thyroid cancer, the K is for renal cell carcinoma, right? So just something to keep in mind. And remember, multiple myeloma is also causes lytic lesions. And then remember that breast cancer, again, can do both lytic and blastic lesions, right? Same thing with lung cancer, to be honest. Lung cancer can actually cause both lytic and blastic lesions. But classically, on MBM exams, lung cancer causes lytic lesions. And then, remember, lytic lesions will show up as radiolucent on imaging versus blastic lesions that are radiodense on imaging, right? Because lytic lesions, you're literally like drilling through bone, right? But blastic lesions, you're literally building bone, right? Even if that bone is very weak, right? That's why these people tend to have a lot of pathological fractures, right? And remember that, usually if they want to test like spinal cord compression and bone mets on MBM exams, they usually test it in the context of either like a pathologic fracture, or they can test it in the context of hypercalcemia, or they can test it in the context of a person having a spinal cord compression, right? They love to go after that spinal cord compression, right? And remember that the reason that many malignancies love to metastasize to the bone is because of this thing called the Batson vertebral plexus, right? So it's basically like a plexus that connects the IVC to like some blood vessels that kind of sort, basically like your vena cava to some blood vessels that surround the spine, right? So because of that, right, you have like just this constant stream of people just getting these bone mets, right? Because those malignancies, obviously, if a malignancy has like mets, right, or some malignant cells get into the bloodstream, if you have something that is connected to like your IVC, that's definitely going to shoot some of those cancer cells towards the bone, and the person is going to get in trouble. Right. And then to wrap up today, so I guess, this is a rapid review podcast, but really this is a bone pathology podcast for step 2 CK. But to wrap up, what's the mechanism behind hypercalcemia in a person that has multiple myeloma? Well, I hope you're telling me that it's because the plasma cells in multiple myeloma, right, they are making interleukin-1, right? And that interleukin-1, another name for it is osteoclast activating factor, right? So remember, when you activate an osteoclast, that osteoclast is going to release, it's going to resorb bone. And when you resorb bone, right, that's gonna decrease the person's bone marrow density. And then they're also going to get hypercalcemia at the same time as well. And then the mechanism behind hypercalcemia in sarcoidosis, right? Don't forget that, right? Those are epithelioid macrophages that surround the granuloma, right? Those things make 1-alpha-hydroxylase. 1-alpha-hydroxylase will convert calcidiol, which is also called 25-hydroxyvitamin D, to calcitriol, which is 125-dihydroxyvitamin D, right? And then that 125-dihydroxyvitamin D or calcitriol, right, is going to cause an increased reabsorption of calcium and phosphate in the gut. So that's how people get hypercalcemia. So I think I'm going to go ahead and pause here. The key things I'll just say is please subscribe to the YouTube channel. That's where I have all my videos, Divine Intervention, USMLE podcasts and videos. But if you want the slides, you know, they're on the website, divineinterventionpodcast.com. You can subscribe to the website whenever I make a new podcast or whatever. You'll get an email notification. And then if you need one-on-one tutoring for the USMLE Step 1, Step 2 CK, Step 3 exams, preclinical med school exams, third-year shelf exams. If you're a medicine resident, I need tutoring for like your internal medicine in training exam or your internal medicine ABIM board exam. I do also offer tutoring for those. And then again, I've talked about the course that's coming up next month from the 3rd to the 6th, right? The 3rd is the test taking strategies course for 2.5 hours. And then from the 4th to the 6th is the 16.5 hour comprehensive step 2 CK review. So if you're interested in any of those, again, just shoot me an email. So, and then please subscribe to the podcast as well. You know, it's on Apple Podcasts, it's on Google Play, it's on Spotify. And then the final thing I would say, let me talk about a life lesson, right? So this is a classic problem that many med students, and I've made this mistake myself. I'm not, you know, going to do some holier than thou speech here. I've made this mistake myself a lot, right? But, you know, I'm beginning to learn my lesson so that I don't keep making these mistakes. But is this phenomenon of making too much change? What do I mean by that, right? So the thing is, for example, I'll give you a classic example. I'm sure many med students can relate to this. You come into med school, you know, you meet an upperclassman, you get advice. This upperclassman says, you know what, for this exam, just read this one book, you know, read first aid, understand it, commit it to memory, and you crush your exams. And you start off on that footing. But then let's say 2 weeks into your start of med school, you see someone using like some resource X. I don't want to start mentioning specific resources. Using resource X, and you're like, man, wow, this resource. And this classmate tells you like, oh, how so good this resource is, blah, blah, blah. And you're like, you know what, let me try this resource. So you stop the original plan you had, which was sound from the beginning. And then you see another classmate that maybe you have like a study session or you're in a study group and you see this classmate answering all the questions. And you ask the classmate, what's your secret? Oh, you know, I'm using this resource. Why? And you're like, maybe resource Y is better than resource X. So you switch to that. And then you see another classmate that, wow, is doing this really good big flash card deck that is like many million cards. You get my drift. And you're like, man, this classmate maybe is really succeeding. Wow, this person is in the zone, really crushing it academically, right? And then you switch to that. Do you know that when you keep making these switches, you never get anything done, right? So I just want to say that sometimes switching to something that looks better is not always the best move. Many times, many people, the thing that has kind of grounded them to a halt in life is that they never start something and just follow through with it to the end, right? Come what may. Some people just like to make changes. And the thing is, the reason that many people like making changes is there's this human desire or need for what is exciting, for what it has like is like vivacious, like, right? But the thing is, sometimes it's just good to be good, old, and boring and just do that. Like, come up with a good plan from the outset, but then just stick with it. Even if you see so many great, amazing other things that, oh, wow, this thing can... is very exciting. Oh, this thing is very awesome. This thing is very this thing looks very hot and sexy. No, right? You don't always have to do hot and sexy, right? So because I've definitely made that mistake in life where, you know, you keep going from one thing to the other, one thing to the other, one thing to the other. You're always trying to find the next best thing. Now define what a good thing is for you from the beginning and just stick with it, right? Like, there are people that can succeed ridiculously on the step 1, step 2 CK, step 3 exams without even touching a flashcard deck, right? There are some people that do well on step 1 and don't even touch first aid. There are people that do well on step 1 that don't use a flashcard deck. There are people that succeed and they only watch videos, or they don't do like the most popular QBank in the world, or they don't do this, they don't do that, right? So the thing is, you need to find what works for you, right? I mean, like, to be honest with you, in my tutoring, one of my one-on-one tutoring, probably one of the biggest things I do with people is I make plans with them just to keep them in line, keep them in check. Because people just like to keep changing plans, right? Like, sit down, seek good counsel, make a good plan from the beginning. But stick with it. Even if you see other exciting, sexy things along the way, just let it go. And again, I'm not using this word sexy as to be like derogatory or anything like that. you kind of get my drift. Okay, I'm trying to be politically correct, I guess, in my speech here. But you just need to be, so again, don't mean to offend anyone or any particular sex. So my apologies just in advance, I guess. But, you know, you don't need to keep changing plans. Just kind of stick it out, right? I mean, even the Bible says that he that endures to the end is the one that will be saved, right? And there's even a part of the Bible, like Isaac, God told Isaac, you know, you don't have to move to this new place. Stay where you are, sow in that land. And Isaac sowed in that land and he got like 100+ fold in terms of returns, right? So you don't always have to keep jumping, right? If you find a good plan, right? Like if I tell you how I studied for step one, it's very unorthodox. I barely touched first aid for the USMLE step one. But at the end, I ended up succeeding really well, right? So just going to be mindful of that when you're changing plan, right? Like the fact that, oh, someone is doing, oh, wow, this person runs 10 miles a day. Wow. You don't have to do that. Maybe what may work for you may be just walking for 30 to 45 minutes a day. But you're slow and steady, you are still going to lose weight. You're still going to have great cardiovascular health and all those things, right? So it's just, I think, particularly important for us to be very prudent with the way we handle our lives. You don't need to keep jumping, because when you keep making one new plan after the other, then you slow yourself down in life, because you may have just stayed with that boring initial plan you made, followed it through, and got the same success quicker than a person that kept changing plan, never got anything done, and then is now behind, right? So just something to keep in mind. So thank you for listening to this podcast. I'll see you in the next podcast. Have a wonderful Sunday, and God bless you. Thank you.